This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of October the 19th, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs. We're going to take a look at what's been going on this past week in the area of federal taxes, specifically taking a look at what's been going on in a lot of cost of living adjustments we're seeing. We're still waiting for the big cost of living adjustment numbers from the IRS that will tell us how 2016 will look. But we're getting to see some other areas that will be of interest. But we're going to start this week with a pair of observations on a case, single case, that was decided this week. That is the case of DJB Holding Company versus Commissioner. And that particular case that we have here with DJB Holding Companies, we have two separate issues. We'll start with the first issue that was kind of the smaller one for the company of the two, and that dealt with the issue of a non-compete agreement. This is 116 AFTR 2nd, paragraph 2015-5313. It is a decision of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, who is hearing this case on appeal from the U.S. Tax Court. Now, an interesting aside, if you're going to look at this from the tax court decision, is that in the tax court, it was called WB Acquisition, Inc. and Subsidiary versus Commissioner. That's because there's a rather complex structure we're going to deal with here. We won't worry about that at this point. We will when we talk about the next issue, because there the complex structure really began to be an issue. But in this particular case, we had a C corporation. And for this particular case, we're just going to worry about the fact it was owned by a partnership that had two S corporation partners, and each of those S corporation were wholly owned by ESOPs. So effectively, any income in the partnership would flow to the S corporation and effectively be tax deferred until distributions came from the ESOP plan. However, what it owned was a C corporation, and obviously anything taxable to the C corporation would pay tax currently. And while that appreciation would be locked inside the C corp, and because we had an ESOP, effectively the double tax would be deferred, I guess, is one way to look at it, because even if we liquidated the C corp, we wouldn't pay a current tax on the external gain. We would rather pick up that external gain as part of the ESOP growth. But we would end up paying a first level tax that is involved if we have it in the C corp that we wouldn't otherwise pay. We wouldn't just pay no tax and then have a deferral. We'd pay a current tax and then have a deferral. So we take a look at it under this structure. In this particular case, they had sold the C corp operation, sold its assets. The company that bought the assets also executed a non-compete agreement with the C corporation and two employees. These employees are effectively the individuals that set up the S corporations and were the principal and potentially only beneficiaries of the ESOPs. So it had a non-compete with WCI, which was the C corp, and it had a non-compete with the two shareholders. Now, the two shareholders, of course, you know, had that non-compete agreement. But what they ended up doing was reporting the $3.4 million, the entire non-compete agreement, as a partnership item. Well, there's one problem with that. For all practical purposes, the one entity that wasn't covered by this agreement was the partnership. So it's clearly not partnership income. Rather, the agreement was with the C corporation and the two employees. Now, the IRS had reclassified the entire amount to the C corporation. The tax court had concluded that the C corporation should have the entire amount because it held that the owners, the two employees, we call them owners for all practical purposes, they were basically, you know, had to work for the WCI because they were officers of WCI, and they had an agreement with the partnership to work with it as well. Well, the Ninth Circuit disagreed with the idea that it was clearly wholly the C corps, but they still concurred with the tax court in result because nobody had argued that part of it should be allocated to any taxpayer other than the partnership and the C corp. And if it wasn't the partnerships, then the C corp was the only thing left in play. But the Ninth Circuit, in a footnote, made it clear that if they had been asked to so decide, they would probably have decided that some of that $3.4 million should have been taxable directly to the shareholders rather than to the C Corp. Now, that's interesting because the IRS, because the Ninth Circuit respected the fact that the shareholders had an independent reign in this. That means the decision here could be somewhat useful if you have a C corporation that's selling. And, of course, one of our problems in a traditional holding of a C corp is double taxation on that sale of assets. It gives some more justification for moving like non-compete and other items, which have always made sense to move outside the C. But this helps us justify and gives an argument at the Ninth Circuit level, so at least you're in the Ninth Circuit, to try to stop the IRS from being able to argue that the whole non-compete should be a corporate item. Now, the only problem was, obviously, this isn't really part of the decision because the decision, nobody asked the court to decide this. But it does at least give some backup to the analysis. Now let's go to the second issue that was decided in this case. And this particular second issue that was decided in this case deals with the question of whether a partnership really existed. Now, it's a rather complex structure they had, as we already mentioned. From the previous case, I told you, we have two ESOPs that owned 100% of two S corporations. Those S corporations each owned 50% of a partnership called WB Partners. WB Partners owned 100% of a C Corp WCI Inc., which was the operating company. Now, this all came to play because the old owners had owned WCI's operations before, what was WCI's business. They had sold it off to a third party who ran into difficulties and wanted to sell it back to them, and they sold it back via this arrangement where WB Partners purchased WCI Inc. and the two S corporations were the partners in WB Partners. They formed ESOPs. Okay, that's our structure. Now, that structure is not really what's under attack here. Rather, there was another issue. They got a large major contract, which was called the NTC operation, the NTC joint venture. The NTC joint venture was what they formed to run this NTC contract. The joint venture was supposedly a partnership between WB Partners, who remember owns 100% of the C Corp, and the C Corp. With 70% of the earnings from the NTC joint venture, which is going to basically take care of this large contract, being allocated to WB Partners and 30% to WCI Inc. Now, remembering our structure, if income goes to WB Partners, it flows to the S Corps, which then flows out to the ESOPs, which means no current taxes paid and taxes be deferred until well into the future. Okay, so they had this structure. Now, the problem we have in this case, having the structure with DJB Holding, was that the IRS claimed no tax partnership actually existed. And what happened was the IRS, one major complaint the IRS had was that the parent company had really not contributed anything of value to this partnership. They were getting 70% of the earnings, but they hadn't put anything in, and they weren't really doing anything. So there was no real partnership. Well, the owners, basically, let's say, you know, the argument the taxpayer had was, no, WB Partners guaranteed the debt. Or they guaranteed what was going to be the bond. They put up a guarantee that was necessary to get the bond. Now, the IRS said, but that had no real value, and the tax court agreed. And so, in the end, did the Ninth Circuit. The problem was nothing of value was deemed to be contributed in this structure. All they really wanted was to get 70% of the income to the ESOP. Now, there were a number of bad facts that involved this. First thing was that the tax court and the Ninth Circuit noted that, A, WCI had guaranteed the debt, but they claimed, well, WCI's guarantee by itself wasn't enough. Well, as the Ninth Circuit pointed out, the only asset of WB Partners was its shares in this WCI, which itself wasn't adequate to guarantee, so it was some question as to what WB had to really offer here. Secondly, the two employees also gave personal guarantees. And in fact, in testimony, an employee for one of the companies that underwrote the bond specifically talked about the analysis they did of the creditworthiness of WCI and the creditworthiness of the two individual employees. Never mentioned they ever did any analysis of the creditworthiness of WB Partners. The Ninth Circuit also noted, if in fact these guarantees were so valuable, and if, as appears to be clear, the real valuable guarantee was offered by the two employees, why in the world weren't they? They were given no fee for offering a guarantee, but WB Partners was. Well, theoretically, they were under employment contract to guarantee, but the court pointed out that, of course, as they did in the first case with a non-compete, that they could have quit at any time. That was one of the issues they pointed out, so it wasn't really a corporate asset. Also, it wasn't really a guarantee here. And they noted that WB was also basically on the hook to guarantee the debt. There's no rational reason why they wouldn't. And therefore, they said, this fee makes no sense. Number two, they said, it's not a real partnership because you didn't really respect it anyway. According to the agreement, 70% of the income was to go to WB Partners. But in reality, what ended up happening was, at the end of the day, only 50.4% actually got allocated there. They gave a bonus to WCI for doing such a good job. Well, it appears, and you know, we don't really have facts here that tell us why that was done, but it's undoubtedly one of those issues where for tax planning purposes or to make the company, or basically for financial purposes, they wanted more income over in the other company, so they just basically paid a bonus out to do it. Well, they said a real true partner would never have agreed to such a bonus when the agreement was wholly they got 70% of the income. So they said for both those reasons, there is no partnership. If there is no partnership, all of this income should be reported by WCI. Therefore, the court held this is all WCI income. There is no tax partnership, and the C Corp has got to pay tax on the entire income from the partnership. Next up, we have some cost of living items that came up. And the Social Security Administration, in a news release, gave us the updated Social Security wage base for 2016. The maximum amount of earnings subject to tax in 2016 is going to stay at $118,500. No change from the 2015 number. Because that doesn't change, some other things automatically don't change under these rules. The retirement earnings level test, owning test level, remain unchanged. That's the amount you can earn before your normal retirement date. If you apply early for Social Security, how much can you earn before you start losing benefits? For years, except the year an employee and a participant attains full retirement age, the maximum amount will stay at $1,570 or $1,310 per month. That's the maximum that could be earned. If in the year you retire, it's going to be $1,310 per month. In the year in which we have, in a year where you're fully retired all year, $15,720 is your number. In the year in which an individual attains their full retirement age, the maximum earnings will go to $41,880 or $3,490 a month will become their maximum for that year they retain full retirement age up until they actually attain the age. So those numbers, again, stay at that level. One number that does change, though, and sometimes is important if you have a client who's looking to do this, the amount for a quarter of coverage will rise from $1,220 to $1,260 in 2016. Now, we understand the concept of quarters of coverage. Basically, they're just credits, and we've heard them referred to as well as credits, so the news release continues to call them quarters of coverage. They're called quarters because you can earn four of them in a calendar year. You earn one quarter for every $1,260 of earnings, self-employment earnings, or FICA wages you have in 2016. You can earn all four quarters in one day, so it doesn't really mean you have to work four different quarters of the year. It doesn't go quarterly. But you can earn no more than four quarters in a single year. Because of those rules, if you need that, and again, these are quarters for getting your minimum number of participating quarters, in order to attain retirement age, you need 40 quarters to make it happen to get a retirement benefit. That amount goes to $1,260. If you have a taxpayer, and sometimes this happens, where you have somebody who's not been in the job pool for whatever reason and is trying to qualify for Social Security, and whenever you do this, you also have to check and make sure they won't qualify for a spousal benefit that's equal to half of their spouse or potentially ex-spouse. But if you're still trying to do it, that number, remember, next year goes to $1,260 for 2016. So that's your planning area, the amount of work they'd have to do in order to get their quarters of coverage for the year is $1,260 for each quarter. Also changing from Social Security on their website, The domestic worker threshold for 2016 has been published. It had been $1,900 in 2015. For 2016, this is going to increase to $2,000. This is the level of payments during the year at which point you're going to have a FICA liability for a domestic worker. That's going to require generally on an individual return, obviously Schedule 8, or potentially a trust return or a state return, a Schedule H to be filed, and all the payroll taxes to be dealt with. That gets a very slight $100 bump for the year 2016. So if you have that situation, have clients that are right on the edge for some reason in that, it's going to go up $100 in 2016. This is, again, the 2016 year. For 2015, the returns you will file next January through April or through October, those returns are still going to be the $1,900 level for that year. Well, a case that we've talked about a year ago went to the Court of Appeals. This is Balestra versus United States. It was a Court of Federal Claims case, originally 113 AFTR 2nd, 2014-887, that came out on May 31st of 2014. It's now been affirmed by the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. It is 116 AFTR 2nd, paragraph 2015-5328. And this case involved a taxpayer who'd received non-qualified deferred compensation from United Airlines. The problem was he vested in that compensation after United filed for bankruptcy, but before their bankruptcy plan was submitted and confirmed. So at the point that he vested, under the rules of vesting, we tax the person on the present value of their vested benefit at the date at which it vests. He paid Medicare taxes on the entire vested benefit. Again, he had no cash at this point. He merely had a right, unsecured right, to be paid by an entity in bankruptcy. As you might guess, there's a decent chance you won't get the whole amount. And in fact, it was substantially reduced in the bankruptcy case, so he got very little of what he had originally put in. He argued that because of that, he should be able to get a refund of some of the FICA because, come on, guys, the thing was in bankruptcy. It clearly wasn't worth that much at that point in time. The Court of Federal Claims had ruled that, in fact, how the IRS regulations interpreted this, while unfair in this case, was reasonable, and the Court of Appeals agreed with the Court of Federal Claims' view in this case. They ruled similarly that the fact is that the legislative history, it's not clear from the law. And by the way, the Court of Federal Claims stated the law itself is a mess in this area, what it says and how it says to handle it. The service had to deal with it. They went back to the legislative history of this, and they noted that, and by the way, the taxpayer was arguing legislative history too to say that it should be fair value. And they said, no, you know, they went back and looked to the very person that they were quoting, former chair of Senate Finance, Senator Lloyd Benson, who was chair when this rule came in many years ago. And he had stated that, you know, the point of this was that the IRS should be able to develop a simple method to calculate present value. The IRS had done it based on a straight discount of present value, very straightforward calculation, very simple calculation. The Federal Circuit found that the IRS had apparently paid careful attention to that. They justified why they did this in the regulation, and the law itself did not require any other method to be used. Therefore, they said, as unfair as it may be, this is the proper result, and therefore he has paid Medicare taxes on which he will never receive the money. Let's be honest, though. Individuals who vested before United filed for bankruptcy back then basically had paid it, they were probably too many years out to file a claim for refund. Those people are never going to get a benefit. Like it or not, this gives Balestra in the same position as the others. It does seem wildly unfair that the time he had to pay it, it was clear he would never get the money. But as the court said, if you got a problem with that, you got to talk to Congress. Congress needs to fix this, and Congress has not fixed it, and it's not likely they will anytime soon. Finally, another cost of living adjustment came up. We have the Patient-Centered Outcome Research Institute fee, the PCORI fee. Notice 2015-60, issued on October the 9th, gave us the new fee. This fee is not on a calendar year, but is a fiscal year. It's based on the federal government's fiscal year. It is money that is used to fund the Patient-Centered Outcome Research Institute that was part of the Affordable Care Act. It's an annual fee. That fee applies to, essentially, the issuer of most health insurance policies for each policy year ending after September 30th, 2012, and before October 1st of 2019. And, similarly, a sponsor of an applicable self-insured health plan, so if you've got somebody who has an HRA in their group, they owe this fee as well for a plan year ending after September 30th, 2012, and before October 1st of 2019. The fee for the 2015-2016 year, and why that year is because it's the federal government's fiscal year, and this is tied to the federal government's fiscal year because it's funding what's effectively a federal agency, rises to $2.17, up from the $2.08 that applied for 2014-2015 and the $2 that applied for the year before that. Again, if your clients are paying this fee, which, you know, many clients who have HRAs will be paying it, and or if you're in the insurance industry, you're paying it, this fee has risen again due to inflation to $2.17 per participant. So you need to make sure that you modify your numbers, you know, for doing your planning, that there's going to be the higher numbers going forward. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of October 19th, 2015. Be sure to join us next week when we talk about more developments in the area of federal taxes. As well, we'll have information related to the links to cases discussed in today's session and the other items discussed on our website at www.currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. We also tend to post there when developments occur as they happen during the week, as we get time to write things up. So if you want to keep up on federal taxes, visit us at www.currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. And be sure to come back next week when we'll talk about the new developments in the area of federal taxes.